Welcome to today's Peak Prosperity Podcast. I'm your host, Adam Taggart, and today we're going to talk in depth about hedging. As discussed lately on our website, the stock and bond markets appear dangerously overvalued at this point. For example, the S&P, which has risen 200% in more or less of a straight 45-degree line since 2009, hasn't experienced a 10% correction in over 34 months. And since the end of 2012, it has dropped to test its 200 daily moving average 0 times. Forgetting for a moment about the many fundamental reasons why this market should correct, just looking at the technical warning signs that are multiplying, it seems increasingly likely that a correction is near, if not imminent. And with the lack of prior dips to let out the building pressure, this one could be a doozy. So how can the regular investor reduce the impact a nasty correction can wreak on their portfolio? Well, there are a number of investment vehicles that can offer insurance against lower prices, in much the same way your home or car insurance offers protection. The practice of using these instruments is called hedging. Here to talk with us about the ins and outs of hedging are Mike Preston and John Lodra, lead partners at New Harbor Financial. New Harbor is the financial advisory firm officially endorsed by Peak Prosperity. And for full disclosure, we have a business relationship with them, which we always disclose when we have them on the podcast, which you'll find within the write-up that's going to accompany this discussion. And so now let's dive in. Mike, John, are you guys ready to talk about hedging?
Sure, Adam. Hi, this is Mike. Thanks for having us on the podcast today.
Hello, this is John. Hello, Adam, and hello to the listeners out there.
Great. Well, guys, thanks for joining me today. We've had a lot of interest in this topic since we published the most recent piece on the site that sort of gave an overview of hedging. And I want to get a little bit more in-depth into the material here with the two of you. So I guess starting, in New Harbor's sort of professional perspective, what role does hedging play in portfolio management?
Well, I can start us off there, Adam. This is John again. Well, you know, just I think it's very appropriate at the outset here to really talk about really what is hedging. And we'll start at a real elementary level here, because I'm sure there are, you know, many different levels of understanding on the part of your listeners as to what we mean by hedging. You know, first, let me make it very clear that there is no free lunch. Hedging is by no means a free lunch. In fact, by definition, hedging approaches, strategies, if you will, have a cost to them. And that cost is either in the form of an outright cost paying for some form of insurance or in the form of a lost opportunity. You know, in other words, giving away some potential upside in return for some protection against a downward adverse move in a position that one might hold. And really, when, you know, evaluating the timeliness or appropriateness of hedging, you know, an investor really needs to ask themselves, you know, and I say this somewhat rhetorically, but, you know, do they believe that there is downside in the market? You know, certainly any given day you can go to CNBC and see any number of articles where one is left to believe that the market is certainly going to go up, and the only question to be asked is how much is it going to go up? So, you know, we've noticed, you know, in many of the folks we've spoken to the last several months and, you know, 12, 18 months, that though they may, you know, theoretically or intellectually understand that markets go down, how they're positioned, many of these folks speaks that they believe that there isn't a likelihood of a downturn. You know, they might be fully or nearly fully invested. So one really needs to, you know, hedging really needs to be based on a premise that markets not only theoretically can go down, but have a likelihood of going down, and therefore the cost of hedging can be justified in the sense that it's likely to be less than the cost of an unhedged portfolio in the event of an adverse downward move against a position that one holds.
Good. Well, thanks for that clarity. I mean, I tend to think of it, again, I think I used the word insurance in the introduction, but I think of it a lot like insurance, just the way that, you know, my family of four, we're probably going to spend somewhere around $10,000 this year in health insurance. And, you know, that's largely to protect against a large healthcare bill should, you know, one of us have a really serious accident or illness. And at the end of the year, while I sure wish healthcare insurance costs were lower, I'm usually very glad that, you know, if I don't have a big illness or a big accident that requires hospitalization, meaning if my insurance actually doesn't get called into use, that's actually a good outcome. And it sounds like you're saying that's sort of the way to be thinking about hedging here, that it's a regular cost the way that your monthly insurance bill is, and if at the end of the year there hasn't been a disastrous market crash, it means that your core positions have done well and you actually should be pretty grateful. Is that a good way to look at it?
Absolutely, a perfect way to look at it. It's basically saying, yeah, there's the potential for a catastrophic event, one that I can't afford to be unmitigated against, so therefore I'm willing to pay something, again, either an outright cost or lost opportunity to protect against that potentially catastrophic event.
Okay, great. So, with that in mind, as you take on clients who understand that and perhaps maybe haven't hedged before, how do you look at a portfolio when you're constructing it and determine how best to apply hedging to it?
Adam, this is Mike. I think I'll respond to that. Going back to your analogy just a minute ago, the health insurance premium. I think it's a very good analogy. There are some slight differences, though. For instance, as long as you're alive, you're going to need health insurance. There are times to have insurance in your portfolio, in your investment portfolio, but it's not all the time. I want to make that distinction that we don't necessarily want to be fully invested and then have insurance all the time in every environment. There are other ways to hedge or to reduce risk in a portfolio. In the scenario that we find ourselves in now, here today, in September of 2014, the environment is highly risky. You mentioned some of the technical factors early on in this call. We could layer in some fundamental factors on top of it, but suffice it to say, this is one of the very few handful of the riskiest times this market has seen in the last 70 years or so. So having said that, we first and foremost want to reduce risk right away. And that means coming off a fully 100% or even 80% invested portfolio that might be invested in stocks or stock mutual funds. So the first thing we're going to do is raise cash. And we're going to get down to an equity allocation we feel comfortable with given the fundamental and technical environment. And for us here at New Harbor, that's down below 20% stocks right now. So when you ask from our perspective, how do we construct a portfolio? First, we get down to a risk level we feel comfortable with, and then we're going to look at what remains and what of that remaining exposure do we want to hedge. Now, for instance, we have some exposure into some areas that we think are undervalued, like precious metals miners, mining stocks. We have an associated hedge with that mining exposure. We've got less than 10% in mining stocks, but we have a put option that will give us a floor which that position can't fall below and will essentially offset losses below a certain point. Same goes with some precious metals that we hold in accounts. So there's really a lot of other things to think about, too. I think I'll pause there for just a minute and maybe hit some other points in a second.
Okay. But your key point there is that obviously one of the things that a financial advisor does is sort of assess the makeup of the market and then creates a hedging position that's appropriate for the given market condition. And so there might be times where markets are looking dangerously overvalued. Obviously, hedging probably needs to be deployed more aggressively then. There may be times after large sell-offs or whatnot where hedging might be less required or less appropriate, or at least maybe different types of hedging might be more appropriate in certain conditions versus others. Is that accurate?
Yeah, that is accurate, Adam. What you're really talking about there is the difference between hedging and speculation, in my opinion. It's important for the listener to understand the difference. Hedging is something that you do to avoid a large loss. So if you have to have a fully invested portfolio for some reason, and some people do, because they might have highly appreciated stock that they're not willing to sell, or for some other reason they have to stay exposed to the stock market, you're going to want to make sure that you carry a hedge of some sort in most market environments, certainly in the present market environment. But and what we're doing here, for the most part, is hedging. Even though we think we're in a fundamental and technical environment that is almost certainly going to be disappointing for people that are long the stock market, another way of saying that we think the stock market will go down, we're still not speculating on a market decline. So the difference to us is when you're hedging, you're still in the market is in rarefied air like it is now. However, it hasn't done anything wrong yet. the market really hasn't gone down appreciably yet. And so that's an environment that we think is ripe for raising cash and hedging what exposure that you do have. However, if we start to have a material breakdown in the market followed by a continued breakdown in internals, and we start to see a trend change to the downside, potentially with some rallies back to resistance, then we're going to see a different character in this market, and that could be an altogether different story. Then you may very well, or we may very well, consider doing some more speculative type trades versus just straight out hedging. Other things that we would look at when deciding, how to construct a portfolio and how to hedge that portfolio would be to take a look at the tax structure of the account. If it's an IRA account, it's quite easy to reduce equity exposure and not worry about tax considerations and raise a lot of cash. And if one is really concerned about the market, it's hard for us to argue that that's not the right thing to do, to simply just raise cash in the IRA. But as I mentioned earlier, in taxable accounts, you might have highly appreciated stock or concentrated stock that might be inherited that you can't really sell without very large tax consequences. In that case, we'd want to use some different strategies to hedge. For instance, specific strategies that we might get into later, like cashless callers, which involves selling calls and buying puts on some of those concentrated positions.
All right. Well, why don't we start actually introducing what some of the vehicles that can be used to hedge are. And while I know this can get really, really complicated really, really fast, I think we'll just try to keep it at a high level and then, sort of direct people to how they can learn more about certain more complex flavors if they're interested. But, the piece that was put up on the site this week, I think talks about the major ones, which I'll recite here. And if I'm missing anything major out, just let me know. But I think most of the common vehicles that at least I know of that are used for hedging, at least at the individual investor level, are stops, inverse and leveraged ETFs, going short, options, call options, put options are the most basic ones, and futures. Are those, is that pretty much the main set that the individual investor should be thinking of right now, or is there any more we should add to that list?
Yeah, that pretty much covers most of the bases, Adam. There are certainly all kinds of variants and combinations of these tools that one can put together to get, as complex as they want to be. But again, hedging need not be a complex exercise. It can be a simple, and we prefer actually the simple, straightforward approaches based upon good conviction and fundamentals.
Okay. And I know this is going to be hard to have you guys sort of succinctly discuss each on a call of the length that we're going to be on. But let's try our best here and just try to give people at least a little bit of an understanding of what each of these, the pros and cons are, and how New Harbor might consider using them, when they're looking at a portfolio and trying to figure out how to best hedge. So why don't we start with stops? I guess two questions for stops. One really quickly, at a high level, what do you use a stop for, and when is it appropriate to consider?
I can take that one, Adam. This is John. So really, when we're talking about a stop, what we're really talking about is a sell discipline. One of the things that we try very hard as investment managers to be is discipline, both in the entry and exit of positions. We want to have a reason for entering a position, but we also want to have a discipline about what would cause us to exit that position. Because, as the saying goes, you can only spend the gains you keep, and to actually cash in on gains, you have to sell at some point. So stop orders are really a way to impart a sell discipline, okay? And, most brokerage firms have some very easy user interfaces to set up stop orders. There's a couple of variants of stop orders. Again, we don't want to get too detailed here, but there's, what are called stop market orders and stop limit orders. And, they're slightly different. So in a stop market order, basically what happens, and let's assume you're long a stock and you want to sell at some point below where the stock currently is to avoid the possibility of further loss, okay? So a stop market order basically would have you say, I want to sell, if the price of a stock is at $100, and one wants to impart a discipline to sell at $95. They'll enter a stop market order at $95. Now, the way that works in practice is if that $95 levels hit in the gyrations of that stock, it turns that sell order into a market order, basically saying, okay, I want to sell my shares now. And what that does is it guarantees the owner of those shares that they will sell their shares, but it doesn't guarantee the price at which they will sell the shares. All it does is once the price hits 95, the shares are sold to the market at the market price. And if the stock continues to fall, for example, you might get some of the shares executed at 95, some might get executed at 92, some might get executed at 90, and so forth. Of course, it could go the other way. The market could rise, hit 95, and then spike higher, and you might actually sell your shares higher than 95. So a stop market order guarantees an exit, but doesn't guarantee the price. A stop limit order is a way you can guarantee that you'll get that $95 price, but you're not guaranteed to get a complete fill. You know, so it might hit $95, you might sell one share of your 100 shares, and then the market might drop or rise considerably from that 95, and you're not filled on any further of your order because you've specifically said, I only want to sell at 95. So in that case, you guarantee the price, but not the quantity of the sale. Now, one important thing I'd like to point out, and this is really where, you know, we spend a lot of our time, you know, you can certainly pick arbitrary price levels at which you want to enter stop orders, but we think there's great value in using, you know, technical levels, you know, support and resistance levels, for example, that, you know, the market has shown to be sticking points for a stock. Use those levels in defining a strategy for setting stops. Now, most individual investors will want to set hard stops to, you know, so that they can live their lives and play golf or go to their day job or whatever without having to sit in front of their screen all day. We here typically use what we call mental stops. You know, we have a discipline, but rather than have a hard set order in our system, we would rather be pulling the trigger manually so we can kind of work the order more tactfully, if you will, in light of the minute-by-minute gyrations of the market. So that's, you know, we can certainly spend a whole call on stop orders and how they're used, but that's kind of scratches the surface anyways.
Okay. And so it seems like, you know, a very common human dynamic is to, you know, once you're in a hole, sort of, you know, begin to really rely on hope that you're going to get out of that hole, which in the impartial markets, you know, probably is not a winning, successful strategy. So you look at stops as really sort of, as you're saying, a discipline, a mental discipline that you set in advance to say, look, if this stock goes against me, my stop is going to keep me from basically getting into that that vicious cycle of just praying it's going to go up again as the stock, you know, continues to go further down. And so it's sort of my...
Yeah, absolutely. So it's a way to keep yourself from, you know, talking yourself into doing, you know, stupid things, basically.
Great. And so how common a practice is this something that you guys use at New Harbor? Is it something that you use frequently or only for certain types of positions?
We you know, there's not a position we enter that we don't have some exit plan or rationale for why we would exit. So, you know, whether it's a specific price target or a specific price target combined with kind of market behavior of that security, you know, whether it's volume or kind of, you know, technical patterns. So we use them as a matter of routine in our position management for every position that we might hold.
Okay, great. So fairly commonly used instrument. All right, let's go on to the next one here, the inverse ETFs, and then the various leverage flavors of that. And to explain leverage really quickly, an inverse ETF usually tracks some sort of underlying security or index. And that means if the index goes down a percent, if it's an inverse ETF, roughly it should go up a percent. The inverse ETF should go up a percent. Leveraged ETFs just simply use leverage to increase the price relationship so that if the underlying security goes down 1%, a 2x leveraged ETF would go up two times and a 3x ETF would go up three times. I know that there's some time decay and other issues that get in there, which maybe you can talk about, guys. But let's talk about the leveraged ETFs for a moment. Very quickly, do you have anything more intelligent to say about them than my quick summary there? And how often do you guys employ them?
Adam, this is Mike. I think your summary was very good. In our view, inverse and leverage ETFs were really created to bring alternative strategies to the average investor. You know, and they make some alternative strategies like shorting an index or a market or investing in a commodity either long or short. It makes it much easier for the average individual to take a position in those markets. Traditionally, the easiest and purest way to take a position in those markets would be to use futures. Now, we can talk about that potentially a little bit later, just briefly, but for those that don't really have the ability to use futures accounts or outright shorting of securities, these ETFs have made it very easy to do so. And it's really a huge boon for those that have most of their money in IRA accounts, because really it's one of the very, very few ways that you can short a market in an IRA account through an inverse ETF, whether it's 1x, 2x, or 3x. And of course, there's lots of caveats and that we can talk about. People have to be careful with in terms of tracking error and decay and things like that, as you mentioned.
Great. And we should probably talk about shorting really quickly, just because I think we want to contrast shorting versus owning an inverse ETF briefly. Can you guys just give a quick summary of what shorting is?
Absolutely. And while I respond to that, I realize I didn't answer your question about how often do we use inverse and leverage ETFs and or shorting. So I'll kind of tie those together.
Great.
In general, we don't use inverse or leverage ETFs that often. We will wait for a material breakdown, as I talked about earlier, in the market. And if there's a technical reason to do so, we very well may use inverse ETFs to participate in shorting the S&P 500 or some similar index. We're almost certainly going to use a non-leveraged version because it's safer and has less tracking error. For instance, we would probably use like a 1x short ETF on the S&P 500. And so we will use them when it's appropriate to do so. In terms of, you asked, though, questions about shorting. Shorting is a more pure way of participating on the downside, either in an index or an individual stock. You could simply borrow shares in an index fund, let's say, that tracks the S&P 500, and then sell them in the open market, called shorting. So you borrow them from your broker, you sell them in the open market, and then you buy them back later on at presumably a lower price, or hopefully a lower price. The nice thing about shorting directly is that you get very good tracking with the actual index. You don't really drift very far over time. An index or an inverse ETF, and certainly the leverage ETFs, have what's called tracking error because they only track the market movement on a day-to-day, point-to-point basis. And in a very volatile market, you could have a compounding of tracking errors that happens on a daily basis that really adds up to quite a bit over time. That same thing doesn't happen when you directly short either an index ETF or an individual stock.
Okay.
So just a couple of quick caveats there. To be able to short a stock or an index ETF, it has to be borrowable. It has to be on the list of securities that you can borrow from your broker. And then once when you're short that stock or index ETF, you do owe whatever dividends that security might pay out while you're shorted because you borrowed it from somebody else to sell it. So there's a time component or a cost, a dividend cost. With the S&P 500, it's not that high right now. With the current dividend yield of about 1.5% or so, maybe a little bit more, being short the S&P 500 via an index ETF will cost you roughly that same amount, about 1.5% to the negative to pay out the dividend.
Okay. So if I can just summarize, because I know the difference, if you're not familiar with these instruments, the deeper we get into the weeds, it gets a little bit harder to understand one versus the other. But sort of the way I look at it is that if you're going to be holding something for a shorter period of time, consider an inverse ETF more strongly, because if it's for a shorter period of time, that tracking error is less of a factor. If you're going to place a negative bet over a longer period of time, consider shorting. I know that one of the additional risks with shorting, beyond having to pay dividends that might be declared while you're short or things like that, is Unlike an inverse ETF, the most you can lose with an inverse ETF is the initial principal that you put in. In theory, you know, if the trade goes against you, your holdings could theoretically go to zero. So if you put $1,000 at risk, you lose $1,000. With shorting, as I understand it, because you're betting against a stock and a stock has no theoretical limit to its upside, your losses technically have no theoretical limit when you're short, unless you employ some sort of protection like a stop order that we talked about earlier. And I think in the case of a short, you'd actually put in a buy stop order, meaning when your trigger got hit, you would buy back the stock to close out your short. Is that correct?
That is correct, Adam. You would protect a short position by placing a buy stop order at a technical price that you think, if it breaks through to the upside, is likely to keep going. You would place a buy stop order above that technical level. Maybe this is getting a little bit too complicated, but there are other things you can do too. For instance, you can buy calls, which will give you the right to buy a stock at a higher price. That would also protect your short position.
Okay, great. Well, that's a pretty good transition to where we're going to, I think, head next to briefly talk about options. Before we close out the short versus inverse ETF discussion, it sounds like you guys don't use these as much as you use stops. Are they ones that you use from time to time in the arsenal? And if so, just when are the main instances in which somebody should be considering either one of those?
Yeah. Well, this is John again, Adam. I want to make sure we always kind of remember the distinction between hedging and speculating, because it's very easy in a discussion of shorting to confuse the two. Again, if you're just shorting a stock or an index and you don't otherwise have a position that's related to that index, that's not hedging. It's speculating against, you know, on a move, which is a fine strategy, but recognize it for what it is and what the premise for that trade is. So, you know, by and large, with the caveats that we said, we find that the inverse ETFs tend to be a little bit more easy to use in a typical client's account for several reasons, not the least of which, again, for shorting positions, you need to have a margin agreement on file. And, we tended to hold, short positions, certainly in a hedging context or even an outright short position for a very short period of time. So some of the tracking error considerations that we talked about don't tend to be material for us. They are very, very easy to trade. You know, we're always, focused on liquidity and ease of trade. And, there have been very few instances where we felt we can't accomplish with an inverse ETF what would otherwise need to be accomplished by shorting a specific security.
Okay. Great. Well, that's really good to summarize there. So it sounds like, when staying on the hedging side of the hedging versus speculating line, ways to apply both, but generally for the individual investor, usually use these in short bursts. Inverse ETFs tend to work just about as well as shorting, yet give you the protection of not having that open-ended downside that you have with shorting.
That's right.
Great. All right. So let's move into slightly more complicated or complex instruments. Let's move into options. Mike, you had just mentioned call options. But if you could just give a really quick summary of what an option is and the difference between the two main ones, call options and put options, we can then talk really quickly about how they're used to hedge.
Okay, Adam, this is Mike. I'm just going to cover them briefly, and if you think I should go into more detail, then I will. But in the interest of time and try to stay within the scope of this podcast, I'll try to keep it brief. A call option is a right to buy a security. Okay, so if I want to buy the S&P 500, I'm just going to stay with something very broad here. I can buy a call option, and that will cost me what's called a premium, to buy the S&P at a certain price. So here with the S&P roughly around 2,000, darn close to it, at 2,000 I can buy a call option to buy the S&P at 2,100, let's say. And so that's 100 points, or about 5% above where we are right now. And I could say I want to buy the S&P 500 at 2,100 anytime between now and, let's say, January. So a call option, all options actually, will have a strike price, in this case 2100, and an expiration date, in this case January. And usually it's the third Friday of every month. So that would be the third Friday in January that the option would expire. Now, I'm not actually looking at a quote screen right now, so I'm going to just make up some numbers. But that particular option might cost something like 15 points, or $1,500 per 100 shares. Okay, so if the S&P were to go up above 2100, and by expiration it remained above 2100, I could then go ahead and buy the S&P 500 or the ETF SPY as well at 2100, no matter how high it went. It could go to 5,000. I'll still buy it at 2100. Now, of course, it has to go above 2100 for me to make a profit at all. And frankly, it has to go above 21 plus the option price I paid for me to even break even. If you think about it in this example, it has to go to 2100 plus the $15 premium I paid. So it's got to go to 2115, or else I won't make any money. I'll lose the entire premium paid if it closes below 2100. So that, in a nutshell, is a call option, a right to buy. A put option, on the other hand, is a right to sell. And that's where we use puts. That's why we use puts as insurance in portfolios. So with the S&P 500 trading at around 2,000, we might say, okay, we want to buy a put option, which gives us a right to sell the S&P 500 at some point in the future at some lower price. Doesn't have to be a lower price. It could be the same price or even a higher price than we're presently at. But in the context of what we do, it's usually at a price below. And it really fits very well into the analogy of the insurance you talked about earlier, because then you could choose your deductible. So say the S&P 500 is trading at 2,000, I might say, well, if it drops by 10% or more, I want to start to have some insurance kick in. In that case, you would buy a put option with a strike price of 1,800, which is 10% lower than where we are right now, and you'd pick an expiration date. I'll stick with the same January, the third Friday in January expiration. So that option might cost $10, let's say. So if the S&P 500 stays above 1,800 between now and January, that option will expire worthless and we'd lose our $10. However, if it did drop below 1,800, no matter how far below 1,800 it dropped, we'd have the right to sell the S&P 500 in this example at 1,800. And so here the math works out for the break-even point at 1,800 minus the premium paid of 10, anywhere below 1,790, we're actually making a profit on that position. If it's a speculation, we'd call it a profit. If it's a speculative position, otherwise, if it's a hedge, it's simply offsetting losses in the stock component. So in as few words as possible, that those are the two main types of options.
Adam, I would just like to kind of tag on to Mike's great introduction there. You know, in the context of hedging, particularly given what we've hopefully clearly made as our view right here and now, that downside risk in the stock market is significant and perhaps even more likely than upside moves from here, I want to make the point that both kinds of options can both be bought and sold. And Mike used the example of buying a call option at a higher price. Now, right here and now, that's not a trade that we'd be inclined to make, because that's a bullish trade. More likely, we would be inclined to sell a call option against an underlying investment that we have. Again, it could be the S&P 500 or some other long stock position. And by selling an option, we get paid a premium from the market. So that premium does afford some downside protection. You know, whereas a put option gives you an absolute protection below a certain level, selling call options, otherwise known as covered call selling, provides some degree of protection, but that protection is limited to the amount of premium that you take in. And we can combine these strategies together to, for example, do what's called a costless caller, where we sell a call option and use the proceeds from that call option to pay for the cost of the put option on the downside. So it can be made to be a costless caller, so to speak. Just wanted to make that clarification in light of the environment we're now in and what we would be more inclined to do with call options right here now.
Thanks. I'm really glad you did that. you share that example because I sort of think a lot of these instruments we're talking about here is sort of like Lego pieces or Tinker Toys, where you can put them together in all sorts of different combinations create all sorts of more intelligent hedges than just the basic building blocks alone allow you to do. And it can get very complicated very fast. And even if somebody didn't follow exactly the logic of how you just described the costless collar, although I think you did a great job explaining it, I hope it at least gets across the point that you can combine these things together to create really powerful forms of protection, and in certain cases, ones that can provide better protection, and even the potential for either more upside or a safer form of upside than each one of these things individually. And we'll get to this in a moment, but this is one of the reasons why, especially as you get into using the more complicated forms of hedging, you really want to work with an advisor. One, because it takes it takes time to understand how to use these instruments safely and understand their behavior. But secondly, you really want to be able to leverage somebody's expertise who knows how to combine these things in really effective ways, like you just described there with the costless collar. All right. Well, so I would imagine in today's market, having options are probably a fairly compelling form of ways to hedge downside risk to consider for a couple of reasons. One, because they have that leverage factor where I think, as you said, Mike, typically underlying any individual options contract is 100 shares of the index or security that you're buying the option on. And one of the ways I think of options is it's a way to commit a limited amount of money for a disproportionately high return if your hedge actually indeed gets exercised. And of course, if it doesn't, just sort of like health insurance, you paid the premium and you quote unquote lose the premium, you don't get it back, but at least it was giving you insurance while you had it deployed. Is that a fair way to think about it?
Yeah, I think that's very concise and very accurate, Adam. And I would just mention again that options also give you the ability, and it's easy to understand on the put side, they give you the ability to pick a deductible, so to speak. If you've got concentrated stock positions or you're highly invested in the market, you can choose how much of a downturn you can tolerate. That the larger the downturn you can tolerate, the further out of the money the puts that you could buy for that particular portfolio or account. And of course, there's some calculations that you'd have to do to decide how many puts to buy. But if you can tolerate a 25% downturn, then you would be buying puts on the S&P at 1,500 or so. And the further out of the money that you buy, the cheaper it is for that insurance. But of course, the higher the deductible, just like health or auto insurance.
Right, right. And we're skimming over a lot of the complexity of options here. There's a huge time decay factor in options, and the pricing of options is it's a very sophisticated and very nonlinear pricing mechanism. There's a famous calculation called the Black-Scholes theory that's used to in valuing options. They tend to be incredibly sensitive to the volatility of the underlying stock. We're not going to get into all that detail here, but it's important for us to emphasize. The main reason why I'm emphasizing this is just to underscore that the average person shouldn't just wade in and start trading options without any prior experience by themselves. It's really something that you should get experience with under the guidance of somebody who understands them well. And as you'll hear me reiterate a lot, both on the site and in this podcast, starting with a financial advisor that is seasoned in their use, and really learning from them how they deploy them is really the best way to start. Guys, anything about that you want to add?
I think you tied it up nicely there, Adam.
All right, great. So just in the interest of time, I want to briefly just mention what futures are. I don't think futures is something that many average investors should be dabbling with, at least early on in their hedging forays, but it is something that's useful to know. And again, it's something that I think under the guidance of a experienced financial advisor, the right type of individual investor could be considering futures. So if one of you guys could just give a brief overview of what it is and just opine on the type of person that perhaps should be considering futures, who it might be appropriate for, that would be useful.
Well, I think futures accounts would be appropriate for fairly sophisticated investors that understand how to use them and understand the leverage that's involved. Futures accounts, if used properly, are wonderful. The futures are wonderful tools because they really are a pure form of being able to take a long or a short position in many different commodities and stock market indexes. Essentially, if we just stick with the S&P for a minute here, you can buy or sell the S&P, and you can pick a contract month for delivery. Typically, it's anywhere. It's generally about 90 days out is when each contract expires. And for very little money or very little margin, you can control a heck of a lot of stock. So, for instance, with the E-mini S&P 500, that contract is worth $50 a point. And if you think about the S&P at 2,000, $50 times 2,000 is $100,000 worth of stock. Okay, so you can buy or sell $100,000 worth of stock in a futures account with only about $5,000 margin required. That's a 20 to 1 leverage ratio. And it's also very pure in the sense that there's really no tracking risk involved, as we talked about earlier with inverse ETFs. There's not really many moving parts like options, for instance. It's very simple. You can expect to have a negative drift or time loss of about 1.5% on the S&P 500 because of the dividend that I mentioned earlier. Though you're not actually paying out the dividend, the futures market is priced it's priced so that it's really the same as being short the stocks in the S&P 500. Otherwise, it'd be an arbitrage opportunity. But if you're sophisticated and you want to hedge this way or even do speculations this way, it's a great way to do it. I would add that you don't have to have a futures account, though, particularly in instruments like the S&P 500. You could simply use an ETF like SPY. And 500 SPY is roughly equivalent to one E-mini S&P 500 future. So as long as it's going to take more cash, you won't get nearly as much leverage out of it, but you can buy or short S&P 500 through the use of SPY, which is not a leveraged ETF. It's just a regular market ETF, and you can mimic a futures account that way. However, a futures account will let you do a lot of other things like buying and selling gold, silver, and other commodities that can only be done in a futures account.
Adam, one thing to add and reinforce there, anytime we talk about leverage, it can do great things for you when the position moves in your favor, but it can do equally bad things for you if the position moves against you. So there is no free lunch, not here, not anywhere.
Oh, well, thanks for underscoring. And just for the last word on futures, it sounds like for the sophisticated, and I'm also going to assume larger investor, given the leverage involved, futures may make sense. It sounds like they offer a lot of the same way to sort of make a leveraged bet the way that that options do, but with fewer moving parts and a simpler structure. But it sounds like for the average investor who probably doesn't have really large positions to put a hedge on to protect, they could probably do a lot of the same thing using ETFs. Is that accurate?
That's exactly right. And we should probably point out that we do not use futures for clients. You have to be a specially registered entity to do a lot with futures. We find that we can adequately get done what we need to get done without the use of futures.
Okay. So glad you said that, because if you're sort of an average investor listening to this podcast, I think it's good to know what futures are and that there might be select cases in the future where they might apply to you, but really focus your attention on the other instruments that we've talked about more than futures. All right, guys. Well, I think done a great job of summarizing some relatively complex topics, hopefully in a distilled, understandable way for the folks that have been listening. A couple of quick questions for you as we wrap things up here. I guess, can you tell me right now, given where the market is, how is the core New Harbor position hedged at the moment?
I can summarize that for you, Adam. This is John. So, again, we talked about, raising cash is one form of hedging, perhaps the cheapest form of hedging, just simply getting out of risk assets to a large degree, and then obviously some of the other tools we talked about. Right here now, we actually are big proponents of holding a large amount of cash. And, you know, getting back to that insurance analogy on your auto, you know, sure, you can have insurance and it can protect you against an accident. But here in New England, we're about to see winter set upon us in a few months. And there are some times where it just doesn't make sense to take your car out of the garage because you can have the best insurance policy ever, but it still makes sense not to drive because the ice or snow or whatever might be out there. That's the equivalent of holding cash. You know, yeah, sure, you can hedge a position, but sometimes it makes sense not to drive. And that's kind of the way we size up this market right now. For a good portion of a client's portfolio, we just do not believe it makes sense to drive. We're talking, you know, 40 to 50% cash in a lot of instances. That which remains, we have, you know, we do have some hedges in place. You know, right now, ironically, because we're holding so much cash, we have fewer hedging instruments because cash is our preferred way to hedge. You know, but we do have some, you know, for example, out-of-the-money put options on gold and gold miner positions because it's fundamentally a good case we can make for those. Technically speaking, and particularly of late, the technical case has gotten much more muddied. In fact, you know, might say negative. So we do believe there's merit in having some downside protection there on the precious metals and mining type investments. You know, we do have a spread transaction, if you will, where we have an inverse position on the Russell 2000 index and a commensurate long position on the S&P 100 index. And the basic premise there is that the small caps have been, as measured by the Russell 2000, they're more overvalued on a fundamental basis, and they've been, on a technical basis, much weaker in a relative strength kind of sense to the large cap. So we believe that, certainly in a downward environment, we believe there's a good likelihood that the large caps will drop less than the small caps, and that spread in such a scenario would likely make some positive return. Yeah, I got to emphasize that, you know, everything we say here is not meant to be an investment recommendation to any listeners, you know, that, you know, hopefully is abundantly clear. But those are two kind of hedges we have in place right now using some of the tools we talked about. But right now, our preferred form of hedging is holding cash.
Okay. Yeah, I find it fitting and a little disturbing I grew up in New England, and John, to hear you sort of use the analogy of sometimes it's just safer not to take your car out of the garage given the weather outside, you know, comparing the elevated level of risk in today's market to a nor'easter, I think is very accurate and just very scary that's where the market is these days. But I think it's a great analogy. And since you're sitting, you know, sounds like more in cash than you are normally because it seems to be the most appropriate response given where the market is right now. Let's assume that the market, you know, does eventually correct. It becomes a more attractive environment for you to actually deploy that cash. Is it correct to assume that as you begin to take bigger positions in the portfolio with that cash, that you will be employing some of the other types of hedges in greater frequency than you are today?
Yeah, Adam, that really depends upon what the market internals look like. If we see a significant or sufficient retreat in valuations that is accompanied by internals, when we say internals, we mean things like volume, new lows, starting to contract, that type of thing, emerging sectors starting to take off after making a bear market low. If we see valuations retreat and we see internals improving and looking better, we will indeed not only increase our positions in risk assets, we'll very likely lift some or all of our hedges. So it really depends upon what the market looks like. We want to make it clear that we don't think, at least from our standpoint of our strategy, we don't always hedge all the time.
You know, one very real scenario, let's say we get a, you know, moderate pullback here. And again, we evaluate things circumstantially as they happen. You know, it's conceivable we would be compelled to want to put some more money to work in the stock market, but we may not feel comfortable doing so without that piece being partially or fully hedged. So Right. One, you know, strategy we could use, and again, this is not a script but a possibility, you know, we could go long some stocks, a stock index, and simultaneously sell a call option against that. which would bring in premium. So we would be long, but we'd be long with some degree of protection as afforded by the premium that we would take in by selling a call option against that position. You know, countless different game plans we could have, but that's just one hypothetical example.
Yeah, I guess I'd suffice it to say, Adam, that the most likely scenario would be a retreat in valuations, and we might not know if we're going to be early, and probably will be early and starting to get more aggressive, particularly early on coming off of a high cash position. We probably will hedge those early positions. You know, if the market deepens and the correction deepens and valuations get even better, and things like volume and breadth start to look very good, then we'll start lifting some hedges.
Great. Well, I'm really glad for your responses to these last couple of questions, because really what I'm trying to surface here is how does a financial advisor who does a lot of risk management like New Harbor does, how do you think about how to apply hedging given the market environment and given what you're doing with your core portfolio? A big reason why Peak Prosperity endorses New Harbor as our financial advisor is this risk management expertise that the firm has. We have talked to lots of different firms out there. Because a lot of these hedging instruments have a cost to them, not all financial advisory firms choose to use them. And from personal experience, I'd say it's the minority that uses them frequently, and certainly, you know, at the extent that the folks here at New Harbor do. And our philosophy is we really want to make sure that first and foremost, we're protecting against losses in portfolios. So we're much less interested in endorsing firms that are swinging for the fences and trying to hit grand slams all the time. We're really looking for somebody who is first and foremost taking a minimize loss approach and is being exceptionally prudent when they do take a long position, that they know what they're going to do if that position turns against them. So I hope those listening have really gotten a little bit of a view inside the heads of you guys in terms of how a professional that thinks from a risk management standpoint actually processes how they make their decisions. And I think you guys have done a really good job of sort of in as understandable a way as possible, kind of give us an idea of sort of what are the elements and the variables that you use when you're trying to make these decisions. So, guys, thank you. I'm looking at the time here. We're just about coming up on the hour. Thank you for, again, taking really what can be a very complex subject and making it, I think, very approachable to the average listener here. As we wrap up, is there anything that you want to say in closing about the practice of hedging or your guys' perspective on how you deploy it?
I don't think so, Adam. I think we've covered it pretty exhaustively here today, and we certainly could talk about it for a lot longer, but I think we'll say that this suffices as a good introductory lesson to Hedging 101. And we just want to say thank you for having us on the podcast today. We really appreciate it.
Well, you're very welcome, guys. And what we'll make sure, as we always do when we have you on the show here, we'll place a link at the bottom of the write-up accompanying this so that if anybody listening wants to talk to you more specifically about hedging and perhaps hedging in their own individual case with their own individual portfolios, we'll provide a way for people to do that. So, Mike, you're going to regret just saying that you can talk extensively further on this topic, because I sense there are going to be people that are going to want to do so with you.
We look forward to doing that. We would love the opportunity.
Okay. Well, Mike and John, thank you guys for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Adam, and thanks, everybody, for listening.
Thank you.